KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generation, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
That's Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his speech before the 1936 Democratic Convention, and we're going to talk about speeches on this day set aside for remembering and honoring U.S. presidents, talk about presidential speeches historically and in the present campaign with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. This is President's Day, and we're going to hear presidential speeches, as we did earlier on during the billboard, hearing Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from the past, as well as speeches of campaign candidates who are vying to be the nation's chief executive. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour to talk all about not only historic speeches by presidents, but recent campaign speeches. We've assembled a trio of academics here. Michael Cohen is with us. He was a professional speechwriter for Governor Bill Richardson, as well as Senator Chris Dodd during their policymaking days, and is the author of a forthcoming book called Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America. It will be out in July. He teaches speech writing at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. And welcome, Michael Cohen.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. Also glad to have Robin Lakoff, professor of linguistics at University of California, Berkeley, who joins us this morning from Berkeley. Her most recent book is The Language War. And welcome, Robin Lakoff.
Oh, good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. We'll also say good morning to Peter Robinson on the other side of the bay, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution who edits the Hoover Digest and is the author of How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life. He served as special assistant and speechwriter to President Ronald Reagan. And welcome, Peter Robinson.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you all aboard. I wanted to talk first with Michael Cohen to get a historical perspective, and I ought to mention that in his book he outlines different kinds of styles of speech-making by presidents, going back to the tub-thumping, as he calls it, of Teddy Roosevelt, and the eloquent speeches of Mario Cuomo and JFK, and plain-spoken talk of Truman and Goldwater, and great communicators like FDR and Reagan. But the speech that seems to stand out for you as really the speech of campaign speeches is Lincoln at Cooper Union in New York City. Why does that speech stand out so much?
Well, you know, Lincoln's speech is maybe the most important campaign speech in American political history because it really did, in a sense, create the sort of create the Republican Party, but also create the divide between the parties, Republicans and Democrats, on the slavery issue. So it was, in many respects, a defining moment for the country, a defining moment of the country, where the country was going on that fundamental issue.
But
and
then,
it was an unusual speech because back in those days there weren't a lot of campaign speeches given by candidates.
It really had a great deal to do, in other words, with vaulting Lincoln to the prominence that he essentially managed to ascend to. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But you also say that the famous Cross of Gold speech by William Jennings Bryan, that electrifying popular speech back in 1896, is the most influential speech in American political history because?
It really did enshrine, in many respects, two very different visions of government and two very different visions of the role of government in the lives of the American people. You know, he was the first sort of major political candidate to sort of speak in really openly populist terms the way that he did. And to argue that government had a responsibility, an affirmative responsibility, to play a more active role in sort of economic lives of the American people. And this was a radical change at that time. And in fact, I was kind of amusing that 4 years before Grover Cleveland, who was a Democratic president, said, you know, the people have a responsibility to show loyalty toward the government. The government does not have a similar responsibility to the people. And he was a Democrat. So Bryan really did change the sort of terms of debate in many respects. In a lot of ways, we are arguing, even to this day, a lot of the themes that he brought up in that speech about the responsibility of government.
But, of course, we should add that Lincoln was elected and Bryan wasn't.
That's true.
So here were two very powerful speeches. One worked,
I guess.
It was
a Pyrrhic victory for Bryan. But it did, in many respects, like I say, crafted the divide also between the two parties, Democrats becoming the party of sort of populism, party of the people, and Republicans being sort of party conservatism.
Bryan's speech was sort of the seminal progressive speech, or what we think of today as progressivism. But you go back to Tocqueville, as so many historians do, and bring Tocqueville to our attention as Well, seeing America through foreign eyes as he did, and seeing these presidential candidacies and their campaign speeches as being sort of full of rhetorical sense of hope and, well, fears as well as aspirations of American people. Those are the keys.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we've come to sort of think of campaigns as being sort of negative and dirty politics. But I think looking at all these speeches, as I have over the past several months or so, it does. What's striking is how the best speeches are the sort of most affirmative speeches. They're the most hopeful speeches, the most visionary speeches. And they are the ones that really chart a sort of positive direction for the country. And I think one of the reasons why Brian's speech didn't work, even though it really had a huge impact, was that it was a divisive speech, that it attacked the sort of Eastern bourgeois, as if you will, and the idle holders of idle capital that that he referred to in the speech. And it did create a really serious division between the farmers and working class and sort of the industrialists of the East. And divisive speeches sometimes work. I mean, Harry Truman used them beautifully. But more often than not, Americans want to hear something positive from their elected leaders.
Talking to Michael Cohen, who is the author of the forthcoming Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shape Modern America. He teaches speech writing at Columbia, the University's School of International and Public Affairs. An example of presidential speech that really sort of hit the mark and was fascinating for me to read about was a speech by Warren Harding, certainly one of the more mediocre presidential speech givers of our time, of this past century, I should say, the 20th century. Mencken compared him to stale bean soup and said he sounded like barking dogs, but managed to hit, well, what Americans wanted. And that's kind of the key to understanding how a lot of these campaign speeches are successful. They wanted a return to normalcy.
Absolutely. I mean, Harding, you know, was by all measures one of our worst presidents, and he was a terrible speaker. I mean, he just was ponderous and had these sort of clunky alliterations he used to use. But he, in 1920, the country was really in turmoil with the sort of fallout from progressivism in the 1910s, and of course the war. People wanted it was sort of an isolationist impulse in the country. There was a desire to see less government activism, and Harding kind of captured that idea and captured that feeling among most Americans that they wanted this return to normalcy. It's funny, you know, we hear a lot about change in the campaign trail right now, and change is often a very, you know, resonant desire among the American people, but so is maintaining the status quo. And there's plenty of speeches in my book that talk about that in fact show that change is not always what Americans want, and in fact Americans often reject change. And in a sense, Harding's victory was, in a sense, a rejection of the progressivism and progressive impulse in the country that had gone on for the past 8 years. I mean, in fact, Warren Harding, for all of his deep unpopularity, won about 60% of the popular vote, which is an astoundingly high number, and I believe was the second highest total at the time in American history.
Again, Michael Cohen with us from New York City this morning. Robin Lakoff is with us from Berkeley. She's professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley and author of The Language War. What do you think Americans want from these candidates now, Robin Lakoff? Change or the status quo?
Well, they certainly sound as if they want change. It's sort of interesting because, at least from what I've heard, Obama's talk of change is kind of open-ended, and he hasn't made it clear exactly what and how he wants to change. So it might be that if someone were to start talking specifics, Americans might say, gee, I don't like this kind of change so much. Let's go back. Change, you know, it's a good word. It's like hope. It refers to the future. It promises a lot. But we don't always like change all that much, and I'm not sure how much we're ready for it now.
Change, in many people's minds, means an African-American president or a woman president, doesn't it?
Well, that's pretty scary.
To many Americans, I suspect it is. I wonder if you agree, though, with Michael Cohen's assessment that a lot of the campaign speeches appeal not only to the future, whether change or status quo, but to the past, and particularly the kind of American folklore and American ideals that are rooted in the past, you know, Alamo and all sorts of signifiers that bring back American memories?
Oh, yeah, because especially, I think, in difficult times, if people can be reminded, you know, yes, we went through this difficulty and that, but we got through it, and we did it well, and we prospered, and here we are now. It's a good reminder. It's a positive thing, and it leads to the future. You know, if we could get through World War II, if we could get through the civil rights struggle and, you know, prevail, if we could, the various other things that we've done, then we can get through this moment of difficulty. We, you know, it's legitimate that we have hope.
Well, let's hear from some of the candidates here. Barack Obama's been criticized for not being substantial or specific or pragmatic enough in his speeches, for getting people all excited with his charisma and not necessarily having. In fact, there was an article in the New York Times just yesterday about how he is getting much more wonky in his speeches just to show that he's perfectly capable of doing this. But get a reaction from you, Robin Lykoff, to a campaign speech that he gave actually on the heels of victory in Iowa.
They said this country was too divided, too disillusioned to ever come together around a common purpose. But on this January night, at this defining moment in history, you have done what the cynics said we couldn't do. You have done what America can do in this new year. In lines that stretched around schools and churches, in small towns and in big cities, you came together as Democrats, Republicans, and independents to stand up and say that we are one nation, we are one people, and our time for change has come.
That's about as direct an appeal as you can get to change, but also talking about this being a defining moment in history. What's your assessment of that, Robin Lykoff?
Well, I remember thinking as I listened to the whole thing, that is a very, not only is it a very effective speech, a lot of its effectiveness has to do with tone of voice more than the words. I think if you just saw them written out on a page, you might say, so what? But it's the way he raises his voice, moves toward a climax. You know, the voice keeps going higher in intensity as he gets through each rhetorical period. The second thing that's interesting to me is that he talks about change. He talks about how something is changing. The speech itself, in terms of its construction, is very old-fashioned. You find, as I was listening, I was projected back to my 10th grade Latin class, where we were reading Cicero and studying Aristotelian theories of oratory, of rhetoric. And exactly what Cicero did in his speeches, the same techniques, the repetition, the alliteration, and so on, Obama was using exactly those techniques of public persuasion. So it was kind of interesting. You use a very old-fashioned way to evoke the future.
It goes back to Cicero, and yet there are cadences and rhythms in his speech that remind one of Black oratory, of,
yes,
some of the more famous recent Black orators.
Yes, and, well, again, I think Martin Luther King was borrowing from traditional rhetoric. These traditions keep getting borrowed and reborrowed, so very much the same, drawing on a lot of different threads, just by the form of the speech, not the content. Reminding people of our common history in a way to draw from both Cicero and Martin Luther King is to say, you know, there are no red states and blue states. There is no black and white. We're all together.
Is that a more difficult stance rhetorically for, or oratorically, I should say, for a woman to take?
I think so. You know, this is anything that you say about how a woman should or shouldn't run for president is up in the air, is total theory at this point. We just don't know. But it does seem to me that women have a harder time because women traditionally have not been part of public discourse. Women, until extremely recently, have not been permitted any sort of role that involved public speaking of any kind. So when women started to be able to get jobs and do work in the public sphere, what we had to do, this was a generation or so ago, was kind of develop a rhetorical model for ourselves, because the male model tended not to work. When we do high flights of rhetoric, if let's say Hillary Clinton had uttered the words that we just heard, it would have sounded pushy, overbearing, strident, you know, that whole range of bad words. So what a woman has to do, I think, in order to sound both persuasive and unthreatening, is to move more toward the conversational and colloquial, you know, the more intimate, homely way that women have always excelled in conversation. The problem then is that conversation is not soaring and inspiring, and it doesn't sound presidential.
It's not
in a way, a woman is between a rock and a hard place.
It's not charismatic.
And, you know, the whole question that wasn't really discussed in the Times article, can a woman be charismatic? Can she be politically charismatic? Since charisma so much of charisma is sexual magnetism, and a woman who is sexually magnetic is not at all the same thing as a man who is. So it's very, whatever you think of Hillary Clinton, I think you have to admire her greatly and respect her for, you know, going into this totally untried, unknown arena.
Let's hear, actually, Hillary Clinton on Super Tuesday.
Now, we know the Republicans won't give up the White House without a fight. Well, let me be clear. I won't let anyone swift vote this country's future. Together, we're going to take back America, because I see an America where our economy works for everyone, not just those at the top, where prosperity is shared and we create good jobs that stay right here in America. I see an America where we stand up to the oil companies and the oil-producing countries, where we launch a clean energy revolution and finally confront the climate crisis. I see an America where we don't just provide health care for some people or most people, but for every single man, woman, and child.
Peter Robinson, let's get you in on this. You hear Senator Clinton, and you think what as a speechwriter?
Well, I think that the excerpt you just played from Senator Clinton confirms everything that Robin Lakoff just said. That speech was written on rhetorical principles. I see an America, I see an America, I see an America. And it was the crowd that led her into that led Hillary Clinton. You could hear the crowd responding. The crowd was actually responding to the speech in a certain sense better than she was delivering the speech. They got her going into it. They got her excitement level up a little bit, and then at the end, they cheered so loudly that she didn't quite know how to talk over them. Should she keep talking? Should she stop talking? This is not easy for her. I'd agree. This is a very interesting question, Michael, and you have a way of asking questions so interesting that I'm not sure I can offer answers that equal them. But the question of women and oratory, I'd agree that Hillary Clinton makes it look difficult. It probably is difficult. On the other hand, there are two counterexamples that come to my mind. I don't know quite how they did it, but they sure did do it. Barbara Jordan is one. Yeah. It seemed to me that she handled rhetoric just beautifully, and there was an undeniable charisma about her. And the other, completely different kind of woman who nevertheless pulled it off, was Margaret Thatcher. Her speeches, as I recall, were not written in a rhetorical sense. They were written more conversationally, and yet somehow or other the sheer force of her personality, her sheer determination seemed to come through the texts. The only line that Margaret Thatcher ever delivered that I can recall that seems to me to have been memorable was in a speech at a Conservative Party conference. This was early on in her career, after then former Prime Minister Heath had reversed his policies in what is still called the famous U-turn in British politics, and Margaret Thatcher looked at the crowd and said, "This lady's not for turning." Standing ovation. It can be done, but I would agree with Robin. It is mighty difficult to do, and Hillary Clinton is forced to invent a pattern as she goes.
Well, here's Peter Robinson on the three candidates. Hillary gives bad speeches badly, as opposed to Obama, who gives bad speeches beautifully, and McCain, who gives beautiful speeches badly.
That's the way I would sum it up, Michael.
Well, actually, I want to get your response to Senator McCain, since you've worked in a Republican administration.
Sure.
And we're going to hear him, actually, after the Potomac victories.
Gotcha.
Hope, my friends, hope is a powerful thing. I can attest to that better than many. For I've seen men's hopes tested in hard and cruel ways that few will ever experience. And I stood astonished at the resilience of their hope in the darkest hours. because it didn't reside in an exaggerated belief in their individual strength, but in the support of their comrades and their faith in our country. My hope for our country resides in my faith in the American character, the character which proudly defends the right to think and do for ourselves, but perceives self-interest in accord with a kinship of ideals, which when called upon, Americans will defend with their very lives. To encourage a country with only rhetoric rather than sound and proven ideas, the trust and the strength and courage of free people is not a promise of hope. It's a platitude.
Well, they're whooping it up there too, Peter Robinson, but somehow missing the fire, even though,
yes.
Well, he's a straight talker, though, isn't
he? Here's what I mean when I say John McCain gives beautiful speeches badly. If you print out the text of that, as I did yesterday evening, and read it, the crafting, the prose is wonderful. The text is better than the speech as he delivered it. It's just the reverse of, I think it was Robin who said a moment ago that if you read Barack Obama's text, it would be very flat. His delivery is in some ways better than the text. However, this is, and so it's extremely well constructed. He has got a very talented writing staff, McCain has. The second point I'd make, I'd like to just drop this into the stream of the conversation because it seems to me important in considering all campaign speeches, is this, that McCain, he was starting to edge into it in a section you didn't quote. Lord knows it's radio, you can't quote everything here, but he went on to outline specific policies. The other aspect of McCain's speech that I find, speeches in general that I find impressive, is that they're rooted in concrete reality. He says what he intends to do. Michael started out by referring to Lincoln's great Cooper Union speech. Lincoln goes back in history and quotes what the Continental Congress did, then what the first Congress meeting under the Constitution did. He's specific as to American history, and then he turns and is very specific about what he believes needs to be done regarding the slavery question of the time. My criticism of Obama is that although the texts are wonderful, it's at this point it's like froth on a wave. It's a beautiful glistening thing, but the substance is lacking. He hasn't yet anchored himself, in my judgment, in concrete policy reality. That may be coming. You said, Michael, a moment ago, he's getting more wonky. I think that the campaign is beginning to release more policy papers. These are intelligent people. They won't miss it. But so far, in my judgment, you know, you think of a speech the way you think of a Broadway song, words and music. Barack has the music, the words, the substance, in my judgment, is thin. With McCain, you get the reverse.
Well, you need a showstopper, is what you're saying, as many times as you can. We're about presidential speeches as well as campaign speeches in our discussion this morning, and we invite you to join us. We're going to hear some more. In fact, we're going to hear the speech that Peter Robinson thinks is the gold standard Ronald Reagan delivered back in 1980, as well as John F. Kennedy's Democrat nomination acceptance speech in 1960. But in the meantime, let's hear from you about what you think of the candidates and their speeches and the rhetoric they're giving us and your reaction to that, as well as historical speeches by presidents that you remember. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, and you can join us now, whether you're listening to us on the radio, the Internet, or the Sirius satellite. Again, it's 866-733-6786, or send us an email. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Talking with Peter Robinson of the Hoover Institution, Robin Lakoff of UC Berkeley, and Michael Cohen of Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. When we return, more speeches and your calls and emails on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
They say that the United States has had its day in the sun, that our nation has passed its zenith. They expect you to tell your children that the American people no longer have the will to cope with their problems, that the future will be one of sacrifice and few opportunities. My fellow citizens, I utterly reject that view. The American people, the most generous on earth, who created the highest standard of living, are not going to accept the notion that we can only make a better world for others by moving backward ourselves. And those who believe we can have no business leading this nation.
Well, that's former President Ronald Reagan giving a speech in 1980 at the convention, the Republican convention, and Peter Robinson, who was a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan, says that's about as good as it gets, gold standard, Peter.
I think so.
Why?
Why? It's direct language. It's memorable language. Reagan has, at this stage in his career, he's an accomplished performer, so he understands the pacing. The voice has a certain bell-like beauty about it. And again, in that speech, you didn't quote the entire speech, nor should you, but if anybody cares to pursue this by looking on the website, you can Google on Reagan 1980 convention address, and what you'll see is that he follows this clarion call with a number of specific policy proposals. So again, he's got words and music. He's bringing to bear on the moment the great American themes, a sense of patriotism, but he's also rooting it in the reality of that moment.
I want to go back to Robin Lakoff and the words and music. There's been a lot of comparison, Robin, as I'm sure you're aware, between Senator Obama and former President John F. Kennedy. And I'd like our listeners to hear the Democratic nomination acceptance speech by John F. Kennedy in 1960. And perhaps we can talk about whether there's words and music there and whether we're hearing similar kinds of tones in Obama's speeches.
And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The frontier of the 1960s, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, the frontier of unfilled hopes and unfilled threats. Woodrow Wilson's new freedom promised our nation a new political and economic framework. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal promised security and succor to those in need. But the new frontier of which I speak, it is not a set of promises. It is a set of challenges. It sums up not what I intend to offer to the American people, but what I intend to ask of them. It appeals to their pride.
That again, President John F. Kennedy. Robin Lakoff, echoing similar words and music in Barack Obama's speeches?
Yes and no. You know, again, what's similar is that he's looking toward the future, you know, a lot of new. Obama doesn't actually say new that much. He just talks about hope and change, which imply new. The new frontier, new challenges, and so on. But what's interesting about the Kennedy speech relative to the Obama speech is that it's a little ambivalent. It doesn't say the future is wonderful, everything's going to be great. It says we have not only new possibilities, but we have new challenges. There are new threats. You know, there are threats that are unknown. We have to worry about them. So that I think, isn't this the speech where, you know, the next few lines are asked not what your country can do for you?
Yes, yes. Written by Arthur Schlesinger.
Yes. I was thinking, Obama, one of Obama's writers now is Ted Sorensen, who is also Kennedy's main writing man. And there's, you know, there seems to be a kind of affinity there. But so JFK was doing some of the same similar things that Obama is doing today. But I think he was envisioning a more maybe mature electorate that's capable of dealing with uncertainties and problems. And, you know, is kind of looking forward to having challenges rather than, you know, we will take care of it all for you.
Michael Cohen, when you hear these campaign speeches, whom do you think of historically in line with the candidates?
It's interesting. I mean, we talked a little bit about Obama and his relationship to both Kennedy and Reagan. I think there's a lot of overlap there. I mean, I think one of the things that Reagan did so effectively was he really spoke to people's need to feel pride in their country again, this sense of optimism. I mean, people forget conservatives for many years have been associated with, you know, Herbert Hoover and with Barry Goldwater. They were sort of the national scolds. And what Reagan did was he crafted this very interesting conservative populist message. I mean, it was sort of an anti-government message, but it was a populist message that really spoke to people's desire to feel sort of pride in their country, to feel hopeful about the future, which, frankly, in 1979, 1980, there wasn't a lot of hope and pride in the country. I mean, this was, I mean, a year after the malaise speech with Jimmy Carter. But I will say one thing about Obama that's very striking is that, I mean, for all of Reagan's optimism, there was a dark side to it. I mean, there was an element. I mean, this was somebody who did on the campaign trail talk about, you know, welfare queens driving Cadillacs, and this was somebody who announced his candidacy in Mississippi and in Neshoba County talking about states' rights. And even Kennedy, who talked a lot about sacrifice and patriotism, I mean, he also, you know, really attacked Republicans unfairly on this issue of the missile gap. What's so striking about Obama is that he is an affirmative populist, which I've never really seen that many. I can't think of many examples of that in American history, is that his populism is really based on this idea of unity and bringing the country together. He doesn't have a straw man. His straw man is sort of, you know, the old ways of doing things, which was in some extent a little bit of Kennedy's straw man.
Well, but it goes back to Tom Watson from Georgia, who was the first populist to try to remove the racial barriers.
Yeah, I mean, it's so striking to see him doing this because he really is. I think if he's successful in winning this campaign and winning the presidency, he really, I mean, in a sense, could change the way we think about populism in this country. We've always thought of populism as being sort of a divisive us versus them kind of argument. But what he's trying to do is crafting a populism that really brings the country together. And I don't know if it's going to work. I mean, history would suggest that it would not work because you consider that it really hasn't been somebody who's played a similar rhetorical chords that he has. But if it works, it would change the way we think about politics, I think.
Well, let us go to our callers, and let's bring our callers into this whole discussion. We go first to Catherine. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi. I'm calling from Palo Alto.
Yeah.
And what strikes me first about the criticism of Obama is that when we have a politician who's boring and wonky and unattractive, as in John Kerry, people criticize him unfairly based on that. So now that we have an attractive, charismatic politician, he's getting criticized on that. And I think that you are unfairly criticizing the voters for not going on content or for going for Obama based on his charisma. I think that the way that you start, that you gather voters, is first on charisma, but that you keep them based on content. And if you look at Obama's Senate record and you look at what the bills that he sponsored, they have much more content than the ones that Hillary Clinton has sponsored. So I think that if you give him a chance, that you will see the content that you're looking for. But to introduce him to the country, you need charisma. You need dynamism.
Charisma before content, Robin Lenkoff? Does that equation work for you?
I would sort of like to see them coming a little more together. I mean, I agree entirely. I wasn't criticizing Obama because he was charismatic. I was saying, you know, like, where's the beef? You know, you want charisma and you want beef. And certainly it's possible that we'll see it, but I think that charismatic oratory can be used to sort of help people through the complexities of wonky, you know, wonky systematicities. And I think that I would like to have seen him be doing that already.
We got a response from Peter Robinson to an email from John who says, I'm a progressive Democrat who will never vote for McCain, but I think he is the best speaker in the race. His speech about hope as a platitude was terrific. I don't think his delivery was flat. I thought it was appropriately straightforward, even homey. I doubt that Lincoln, who was the greatest of all, raised his voice or pounded the audience with his voice. I get very tired of speechifying.
Well, high grades to John McCain on that one. I can't dispute someone's opinion. I think also I would say this: if you looked at it on television, you'd see that John McCain gets a little bit flummoxed by using the teleprompter, where you've got the text scrolling on two glass plates in front of the speaker. The glass plates aren't so visible to the audience. The text is, and McCain just goes from left to right to left to right. He's not absolutely on top of his technique, I would argue. But don't let me get between somebody who wants to admire John McCain and John McCain himself. I won't stop that. By the way, could I mention one other? Robin said something, Michael, that has me thinking now. She talked about going back to her 10th grade Latin, and when you play John Kennedy, I know Ted Sorensen a little bit, boy, is it the classicism of it, the sense of really sharp Ciceronian cadences. And then, of course, I remembered, you remember Kennedy's famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech, but he began by saying 2,000 years ago the proudest boast was Kiwi Romanus sum, I am a citizen of Rome. And this astonishing thing that you're actually, in John Kennedy's case, you're in touch with people who, you're listening to people who are in touch with the entire tradition of Western oratory, going back literally to Cicero. Kennedy, Sorensen, they all studied Cicero. With Obama, I believe, what I hear if you just sit back and listen to it and stop trying to judge the policy content, hard thing for me to try to do, but if when I do that, I hear John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. You get this a sense of classicism, of structure, but also of specifically African-American rhythms. And boy, is that a powerful combination.
Somehow it doesn't work for Hillary, though she's tried it, I think. In fact, she was even ridiculed by some Fox TV people for trying to sound black in early on in the campaign.
Michael, you shocked me. Fox ridiculed Hillary?
Well, actually, here's someone who agrees with you, Peter. Eric from Berkeley writes, I'd like to agree with Peter Robinson about Margaret Thatcher. I heard her speak when I was in college. I disagreed with almost everything she said, but I must say when she said it, for the time when she was speaking, I was with her 100%. I have no idea how she did it. I think women are just as capable to move an audience. I just don't think Hillary is any good at it. Saying it's because she's a woman is a cop-out.
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah,
I think
Michael Cohen.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead,
yeah,
Michael.
It's striking. I think you know the problem with Hillary is not that she's a woman trying to deliver a sort of great oratory. It's that she's Hillary Clinton trying to deliver great oratory. I don't think it works for her. I think every politician has their style of speaking and their effective way of getting their message across. And for Obama, it's these sort of wonderful rhetorical addresses. For Hillary, as you heard in that clip, it's more of a programmatic kind of approach.
Well, here's someone else on the subject of gender. Penelope says, Michelle Obama has been giving very moving, charismatic speeches along the campaign trail. Her speech in Orangeburg, South Carolina brought tears to my eyes. Her style should fit into this whole analysis of male-female oratory. And another listener writes, it's become something of a Hollywood cliche to see the hero ending the movie and saving the day with an eloquent speech filmed from a panning camera and with sentimental music playing. I think America's culture places too much store on the power of oratory. Yes, it can motivate people, excuse me, but there's more to politics than being well-spoken. Politics is about policies, and we need more emphasis on substance and less on style. And let me go to more of your calls. Tom, welcome. Hi.
All right, good morning. I wanted to ask the panelists how they feel about something that struck me and the difference in speeches between Obama and Clinton. I always felt that Obama, when he delivers a speech, you know, I think he emulates the ring of Jack Kennedy's speech or Martin Luther King or even Ronald Reagan's, Rendezvous with Destiny, you know, because he always uses the pronoun, what you can do or you and I or we, whereas Clinton focuses more on what I can do, my experience. I'll be on the ground running from day one and focusing more on the quote-unquote substance issue. And I'm wondering if that's because, as one of your panelists mentioned, a woman running has to almost prove herself in a man's world that, yes, I am capable to, just like, quote-unquote, my husband was able, you know, to carry on these policies for you, what I can do for you. It's almost like, in this day and age, a flip of the famous Jack Kennedy speech of ask not what you can do for your country. It's almost, in this day and age, it's a new youth voting, and maybe we could modify that to ask not, tell not what you can do for your country, but what your country can do through you, which is what I think is the cleverness of the Obama speeches. And that's why I think you know, his power of oratory resembles somewhat Ronald Reagan's. I thought it was kind of unfair when Bill Clinton...
Tom, you're going on a little too long here, and I want to get some response to your comments. Let me go to Robin Lakoff.
Well, there was a lot there. Very interesting. I didn't mean to suggest that a woman can't be rhetorically effective. And one of the other panelists mentioned Barbara Jordan, whom I remember as being absolutely magnificent. It's possible. It's, I think, more difficult now, perhaps, because we're in a more colloquial age. That is, the general expectation of public style has sort of come more to the conversational, which makes it a little harder for a woman to reach, you know, reach higher up. It sounds, you know, maybe more bossy, you know, something like that, that than it would have a generation ago. I agree with the caller that that Clinton uses I and you and I. Again, she's creating a personal, you know, two-person relationship between the people, between the people she's addressing and herself, where the men say we, you know, we can do this, you we and you, you know. So he makes it, a man will make it plural and will identify with the audience. I think really what I'm saying is not that women can't be effective public speakers or that women can't be effective as presidential candidates, which is a very different thing from what Barbara Jordan was doing or maybe also what Margaret Thatcher was doing. It was a different kind of role. But that women in this country, if they want to be effective at the very highest levels, we have to develop a new rhetoric, and Americans need to be able to learn how to listen to it. So saying Hillary Clinton is ineffective may not be quite right. It may be that we're not ready to understand her rhetorical style for what it is.
Well, we've mentioned in terms of women, Margaret Thatcher and Barbara Jordan and Michelle Obama. Now Jan in Point Arena has another name to bring into it, Cynthia McKinnon.
Hi, yes, I think Cynthia McKinney has all those elements in her speaking. I mean, she has optimism, she has content, and she has, as you say, music. And I was just really impressed and excited by hearing her speak. But I also wanted to say that she's running for president, so she's been covering the same material. But I was going to say that also Hillary, or a woman with Hillary's type of voice, I think she could benefit from closer miking, so she doesn't have to scream. And I think when she doesn't scream, her voice has more ability to play the music.
Yeah, you don't want to run into the Howard Dean effect. And thank you, Jan, for the call. In fact, since so many people complain, Peter Robinson, about how negative campaigns are and so filled with attack, there really is a balance when you go after your adversaries or you go after your competition in terms of attacking them and not sounding demagogic or not sounding full of invective.
Absolutely right. You have to. It's a tricky business. On the other hand, as the clip that you played from Reagan showed, it can be done very effectively. Reagan talking about, I, for one, refuse to accept the premise that we can only make a better world by moving backward ourselves, a very direct shot at his then opponent, Jimmy Carter. And furthermore, this is people are always complaining about so-called negative campaigning, but the truth is that if a candidate doesn't draw distinctions between himself or herself and his or her opponent, at some level voters begin to wonder why they're running. People complain. There's a disproportion, in my judgment, but between how much people complain about negative campaigning and how much it really bothers them. There's a certain amount of drawing of contrast that people, in my judgment, voters feel hungry for. They want to know why that candidate thinks he's better than the other candidate.
And Michael Cohen, as I said earlier, you have all these different categories of candidates, long-winded candidates like Jesse Jackson and Bill Clinton, and eloquent candidates like Mario Cuomo and JFK. But then there are also the maudlin speeches of Nixon, of Richard Milhouse Nixon, which don't necessarily, you would think, at least on the surface, wouldn't necessarily play that well, but have actually been successful.
It is amazing, looking back in history, what we know now about Richard Nixon. When you hear some of the Checker speech, for example, which is it's incredibly maudlin, and you read it now, and you just almost want to,
cringe.
It really cringe. But at the time, it had an incredible effect. I mean, it saved his spot on the Republican ticket. People responded absolutely positively to what he was saying, and he came across as the everyman, as sort of the common man trying to, you know, provide for his family. And it was incredibly successful.
His family and his dog, we should mention.
And his dog, of course, right. And in 68, when he ran for president, he actually also cast himself as this sort of voice of the forgotten Americans. And it was a message that really resonated with people. People wanted to, you know, feel like somebody in Washington cared about them, and he was sort of came across as that everyman sort of guy. So maudlin can work occasionally. It's hard, but it can work occasionally.
Again, Michael Cohen was a speechwriter for Bill Richardson, Governor Bill Richardson, as well as Senator Chris Dodd, and is the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, which will be out in July. Here's Fred, who says, who wrote the great speeches, the speaker or a pro writer? Who does it for the current presidential contenders, and does it matter who writes them, and is it possible for a candidate to write his or her own speeches? Those are significant and relevant questions. Michael Cohen?
It does depend. I mean, I think some candidates have, you know, Roosevelt's a good example. Roosevelt relied on a number of different speechwriters, a team of speechwriters who came from different political perspectives. But in the end, you know, he was the one who was sort of that craft the speeches into his voice. But of course, there because of his sort of different speechwriters, there was sort of a patchwork nature to them. But a lot of speakers You know, it's a funny story. In 2004, I read that John Kerry was going to write his own acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention. And, like, I'm sure Peter had the same response, sort of cringe when they saw that. Just the notion that politicians, you know, don't write a lot of speeches anymore, and there's a good reason for it, because it's actually a hard thing to do. And one of the things about Obama that's sort of striking is that it does seem as though much of what he rhetoric he delivers is actually stuff that he's written himself, or stuff that he is sort of speaking ad-libbing, which is incredibly hard thing to do, and it's something that sort of speaks to his sort of facility with words and his sort of facility with language. But for a lot of speakers, I mean, Reagan, for example, I don't think ever could have, and Peter can speak to this more closely, really could have ever done sort of that sort of off-the-cuff kind of speaking.
Well, Reagan actually was okay at improvising speech, Peter Robinson, from what I recall.
Reagan, yes. I was a Reagan writer. I still love the guy. I know I'm at odds with many people in that regard, but I just have to I put that disclaimer out in front of what I'm going to say. To my mind, this relationship between the speaker and the writer, again, Reagan in that one is ideal. From the 40s right up until he became president, he did most of his own writing himself. He was the best editor. This is literally true. He was the best editor I have ever had. He could make line edits with precision. And beautiful judgment about where speech was going to be flat and needed to be picked up and so forth. On the other hand, after he became president and didn't have time, he relied heavily on the speechwriters, but in effect, but trained us. Every speech that went over to the White House, he would send back the next morning with markups. I can recall one speech I wrote. It was 6 pages. For some reason, I remember that. Turned the first page, no comments, second page, third page, all the way to the end, 6 page. Second to last line, he had changed one word. But boy, did that keep me on my toes. Just the assertion that the old man is reading every one of these speeches himself and marking them up. He had such a specific pattern of speaking, and of course his principles by the time he became president. By the time he became president, he was a fully formed figure, both as regards speaking style and policy. So we were stealing from Reagan to give him back to himself in a certain sense. The distance between him and his texts was close to zero. Hillary Clinton, Michael touched on this earlier, that one of the speechwriter's first job is to find a mode, a métier that fits the speaker's personality. When Hillary Clinton said after New Hampshire, "I found my voice," I think we all would have to say, well, not quite. There's still too much distance between her and the kinds of speeches she's trying to give. It's a late moment, but she still needs in this campaign to find a mode of speaking that suits her, that fits her personality. That's what you want. You want the writers and the speaker to work so well together that almost the ideal circumstance is that a piece of writing would go across either person's desk, and the speaker would say, "Did I write that, or did such and such a writer?" That's what you're really after.
It's like writing for an actor, really. In many
ways, exactly what it is. You want to be able to. I wrote for Vice President, as he was then, George H.W. Bush. Much harder job because he was less distinct. When I wrote for Reagan, I and all the others on the staff, you could hear Ronald Reagan's voice in your mind as you wrote. He had such a distinctive style that you could write to it.
Peter Robinson, again, is research fellow at the Hoover Institution and edits the Hoover Digest. He's the author of How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life. Here's Paul, who says, "The issue I have with McCain and Hillary is that they say anything they think people want to hear, but what they say doesn't match their records. Obama, on the other hand, is constant. Also, if you look at Obama's website, there are a lot of concrete ideas. Candidates promise the world during their campaigns, but it means nothing. I don't care what a candidate promises. I'm concerned about what they will do once they're in office. The bottom line for me is that Obama opposed the war, Hillary voted for it, and McCain wants to continue it." That sort of sums up a very strong attitude in terms of these three candidates. The sense one gets, Michael Cohen, is that the speaking style, finding the right voice, as Peter Robinson describes it, and all that, changes as the campaign changes, and there has to be a lot of adaptation. It has to be kind of a mercurial and chameleon-like adaptation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're hearing this now from Obama, who I think has relied in large measure on his sort of inspiring rhetoric and this message of change, but now realizes he needs to be a little more specific. I mean, I personally hope he doesn't get too specific, because I think that actually undercuts the strength of his message, which really is one sort of this inspiring message of change. I think that's really what is the root of his political appeal. So I'd hate to see him get too far away from that. But I think someone like McCain, for example, I must say, it's interesting. I watched McCain's Potomac speech, the one you quoted from earlier, before I came here, and I was just struck by, I don't understand why, from that speech, what John McCain's sort of affirmative message of why he wants to be president. I think that's something he needs to establish. I think I disagree a little bit with Peter. I didn't feel a real strong sense of what he would do as president. I felt a strong sense of sort of moral code, a sense of honor, which I understand, you know, from reading Faith of the Fathers by McCain, it is a real strong element in his personality. But as far as why he wants to be president, what he wants to do as president, I think that's something he needs to be a little clearer on going forward, because I think it's something that will, if he doesn't define himself and define, you know, what his goals are, then the Democratic nominee will do it for him.
You're saying the American people need to hear not only policies, as we've been saying, and some of the substance of those policies, but why this particular candidate wants the presidency.
I mean, I think, yes, I think you listen to Obama, I think it's pretty clear why he's running for president and what his goal is. You can agree with it, you don't agree with it. You can think that it's a fairy tale, as some have said, or not, but I think it's pretty clear. I think it's similar with Hillary. I mean, there's a sort of programmatic element to her campaign. I was struck by McCain complaining about platitudes, and I thought his speech was incredibly platitudinal and that it just didn't really, to me, lay out a real direction for the country.
Well, that's going to have to be the final word here, because we are flat out of time on this President's Day talking about speech-making skills and hearing some historical voices of presidents from the past, as well as talking about those who would be presidents. And I want to thank Michael Cohen, who was a speechwriter both for Governor Bill Richardson and Senator Chris Dodd, and whose book, Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America, will be out in July. He teaches speech writing at Columbia University's School of International Public Affairs. Our thanks also to Robin Lakoff, professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley, who joined us this morning from Berkeley, her most recent book, The Language War, and Peter Robinson, research fellow with the Hoover Institution, who edits the Hoover Digest, author of How Ronald Reagan Changed My Life. He was special assistant and speechwriter to President Ronald Reagan. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, to our producer, Kevin Guillory, and our production assistants, Inga Schlabsdorf and Tita Lauerberg. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.